Welcome to the Legal Nurse Podcast, where you'll get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside the legal nurse consulting business. They'll share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with over 30 years' experience. So join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's your host, Pat Iyer.
My name is Pat Iyer. Welcome to this edition of the Avoid Medical Errors Inner Circle. AME encourages you to aim for health. My guest tonight is Barbara Levin, who is a registered nurse. She is employed as an orthopedic clinical scholar, providing care to patients as a staff nurse in a major hospital in Boston. Barbara is also an author and an editor of books related to medical records and nursing malpractice, as well as legal nurse consulting. She is joining our program tonight to talk about avoiding medical errors from two perspectives. One is as the daughter of a woman who was affected by a medical error, and secondly, as a registered nurse who is involved in day-to-day care, taking care of patients in the hospital. Barbara, would you like to add anything to what I have just said?
You've certainly included a lot about myself. I'm looking forward to sharing more with the audience. We will be talking about Charlotte's story and from the perspective of being the daughter, and we'll also talk about helpful hints that I, as a healthcare provider, can provide to your audience about ways of preventing medical error.
Let's start by having you tell our audience a little bit about Charlotte. What was she like?
Charlotte was considered 61 years young. That's definitely young. And she was a very vibrant woman. She was a woman who had attended two master's programs. One was for speech and language pathology, and the other one was for ministry. She was actually 6 credits away from obtaining her PhD. And she was a woman who loved to work. She loved people. She loved her family. And in addition, she loved skiing. And she had moved to an area where she could ski approximately 5 days a week in the wintertime. So she definitely enjoyed her outdoor activities. She also loved to travel. And she and her husband would travel to all types of interesting places.
And then what caused her to seek out a surgeon? Because this is a story about what transpired during and after surgery.
Exactly. Charlotte actually had heartburn. And conservative methods, such as medications that she was taking and change of eating habits, were not working for her. Her heartburn became so severe that her internal medicine physician referred her to a gastroenterologist, a specialist within that field. And he evaluated her and determined that he wanted to perform a procedure called fundoplication. And this is a surgery considered simple day surgery, as a matter of fact, where they actually put 5 small incisions into your abdomen, and they utilize their instruments and wrap the stomach partway around the esophagus. As I mentioned, it was supposed to be simple day surgery. She would be in the morning and out in the afternoon. And what was so appealing about this surgery to Charlotte was that she would be able to go skiing again within just a couple days period of time. She would be able to return to her work as a minister. And she would also be losing a little bit of weight because the preferred diet after this procedure was clear liquids for a few days. So that all sounded very appealing to her. But truly the reason she was doing this was because her heartburn was so severe. She had that discomfort all the time.
And then what happened with the surgery?
She had her surgery and went to the recovery room. we, the family, were waiting in the waiting area, and the fifth-year resident came out to greet us. And instead of shaking our hand saying, "Hello, pleased to meet you, I'd like to tell you about your loved one," the first thing that he stated was, "I made a mistake." Yes, we were taken aback by that as well. And he told us he made a mistake in that he administered a particular medication to Charlotte and had admitted that he had never read her medical record. Charlotte had a history of renal insufficiency, which has to do with kidneys. So she's had some kidney problems in the past. But because he had never read her medical record and was unaware of her history, he prescribed a medication that put the kidneys into full failure.
Wow. What happened next?
Well, unfortunately, the story then continued on. She was having a lot of pain within the recovery room, and they were giving her several different types of pain medications. Her respiratory rate deteriorated. She became very confused because her oxygen level was going down, and they couldn't quite figure out what was going on with her. And at one point, they actually wondered if she was a drug seeker. Now, Charlotte did not have any history of drug-seeking behaviors. She wasn't utilizing narcotics or addictive medications outside of the hospital. So we were quite surprised to hear that they would just jump to that conclusion. Well, they decided to admit her, and she was admitted to a regular medical surgical floor, and she was having a lot of pain. And her pain continued to get worse, as well as they started noting that she had some shortness of breath issues. They, at one point, they couldn't figure out what was going on with her. We, the family, requested additional consults be brought in. We wanted a pulmonary specialist to come in and care for her. We wanted a nephrologist, which is a kidney specialist, to come take care of her as well. And they did join and reviewed her care and determined that perhaps they needed to do a special test to find out about this respiratory issue because she was having shortness of breath. They questioned whether or not she had any type of blood clots. And so with that, they did a special test, and the test results showed low probability. They didn't feel that she really had any blood clots. Well, unfortunately, the physician who had admitted to not reading her medical record and prescribing that particular medication was the one who did not transcribe that information properly from a typed record into then his note saying that she was had a moderate probability for this blood clot. From there, they decided that they would administer blood thinners to her. They administered three different types of blood thinners to her, and unfortunately, they were not following her lab results.
Is that common to give three of those at one time?
No, it's not. It's not in today, in 2010. Back then, if you questioned if somebody had a blood clot, you may be placed on two medications, not really three. And the reason for the two medications is that one was a pill form, and it would take approximately 72 hours for that pill to then get your blood levels to a reasonable area, so then you could remove one of the other medications. So she had one that was intravenous, that was immediate acting blood thinner, and the other one was a pill. And the pill form takes, as I mentioned, approximately 72 hours to then establish a blood level so that then you can discontinue that intravenous medication.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was injections. But unfortunately, they continued giving her all three, and one of the physicians, this fifth-year resident again, who had reviewed the medical record at that point, had determined that he didn't believe that she did have any blood clots, and he wanted to discontinue the medication of the blood thinners. Unfortunately, that physician never wrote a physician order into the record, and other people, we don't believe, ever really reviewed his note.
So these all three continued, even though at that point at least one of the doctors in her care recognized that it was unnecessary to give her those medications, if I understand it.
That is correct. They felt that she did not have any blood clots, but yet they continued with those medications.
And are these dangerous medications?
Yes, they are. Blood thinners need to be monitored very closely, the dosage, and taking a look at not only the dosage of medication that's being administered, but also what the blood levels are in monitoring a patient. And the medication is delivered based on what your blood levels are. The numbers will fluctuate each time you have a blood draw.
Mm-hmm. How was she feeling at this point in her recovery from surgery?
She was not feeling well at all. She was actually getting weaker and weaker, and she was complaining of abdominal and leg pain, more shortness of breath, back pain. And as a matter of fact, her abdomen was growing on a pretty much a daily basis. And so we as the family kept asking the physicians about this because she was not comfortable at all. And as she was getting weaker, and they were actually monitoring her oxygen levels were dropping very significantly. And at one point, she actually stated to our family that her deceased sister had invited her to heaven.
Wow.
Now being a nurse, when a patient tells me that they feel that they're going to die or that somebody has invited them to heaven, this is a huge red flag. Oftentimes, bad things will happen. Patients oftentimes know. So we as the family, I called the attending physician at home to discuss this with him. And his response to me was that he would be monitoring her closely and not to worry.
And were you worried?
I was very worried. I contacted the staff. I called every shift because I was not there on this particular date. I notified all the staff members on this date about how she felt and what had occurred. And to my surprise, upon reviewing the medical records, on this particular date, when Charlotte was so weak, she was asking the staff if they could assist her with eating because her arms were so weak. The staff actually wrote in the medical record that Charlotte has two arms and she could feed herself.
And what does that imply to you as a healthcare provider when you read something like that?
Well, upon reading this, it tells me that the nursing staff was not listening to their patient. They minimized Charlotte's complaints. They didn't feel that she was being truthful with what she was stating to them. And so they dismissed her. They dismissed her complaints.
Mm-hmm. What happened next?
Well, the next 24 hours were truly a roller coaster. The physicians had realized the next morning that lab work hadn't been ordered for an extended period of time, and they requested that she have her labs drawn first thing in the morning. Now, Charlotte had very tiny veins, and they were tough to find. And prior to this date, she had actually requested a special type of catheter be placed because they did have a hard time drawing her labs. And certainly, if there was more of a discussion between the healthcare providers and Charlotte to understand why she felt this was necessary, perhaps the following sequelae would have never occurred. But anyways, they had written for her to have her labs drawn at 7:30 in the morning, and unfortunately, it took four different people to come through to try to get her labs. And at 5:30, the labs were finally drawn. Unfortunately, the person was only able to obtain a small amount and brought that tube to the lab. Mm-hmm. The lab personnel took a look at it and dismissed the tube, saying that it was just the quantity was insufficient because you have to have a certain amount of blood in each tube in order to test it. That lab tech went home, and the next lab tech that came on at 7 p.m. did test and ran that lab and determined that the blood levels were extremely, extremely low.
And when you say blood levels, what are you referring to?
CBC, specifically a hematocrit and a hemoglobin.
And what does a hemoglobin do?
The hemoglobin and the hematocrit reveal how much blood you have. So if you have normal levels, there's certain norms for women and certain norms for men. Hers was so low that they didn't feel that the result was valid. And if you or I saw this as a low result, we would be sending off another one to validate, you know, and determine was this true or not. And you have to question, was somebody having a huge bleed? Were they bleeding?
Okay.
And her abdomen was growing every day. So this number was so low that this hospital didn't recognize it because people don't really live with such a low number.
Mm-hmm.
And the lab called the nurse at 8 p.m. and reported that to the nurse. And the nurse, unfortunately, discounted this result. And she waited to call the doctor until 11 p.m. So she waited 3 more hours. And when she called and paged the doctor, he didn't return the call until 1 a.m. So you have another 2 hour delay.
So we have a woman who's short of breath, who's getting weaker instead of stronger. Her blood values, as I understand it, are showing that she's got extremely low levels of hemoglobin and hematocrit. And then the nurse delays in the face of all of that information in contacting the physician, and then the physician delays in responding back to the nurse.
Correct.
All right. Go ahead.
And meanwhile, Charlotte is having more episodes of shortness of breath, abdominal pain, back pain, diaphoresis, which is she was sweating and not feeling well at all.
Mm-hmm.
And she was nauseous and vomiting intermittently. So we're at 1 in the morning when the physician did call back and when the nurse spoke with him and reported the very abnormal lab results. Their discussion and plan was just to repeat them in the morning. So unfortunately, the nurse did not request the physician to come and draw the labs. The nurse was unable to draw the labs because she hadn't gone through a class to draw labs. And the lab tech personnel with this facility had, they were not working at this time.
And when you say draw the labs, just so that our audience understands, you're talking about putting a needle into her vein to remove blood for testing.
That is correct, yes. And so there were several hours that went by until somebody did come at 4:30 in the morning and drew the labs, and they were processed at 5:30 in the morning, and they were reported at 6:05, between 6:05 and 6:10 in the morning. But in the meantime, Charlotte called to utilize the commode, the bedside commode, at 6 a.m. And the nurse was very alarmed when she saw her condition. Charlotte was huffing and puffing, was really uncomfortable, was extremely weak, and she was transferred out of bed and put on this commode, and the nurse went right down to the desk to call the doctor. The doctor returned the call, and he was actually the physician who was on call and had explained to the nurse he wanted her to call another doctor. He was not going to come and see his own patient. And this is one of the residents on the team.
Uh-huh. Which left the nurse with no choice at that point.
Exactly.
What happened? And what
exactly.
Then what happened?
Well, then the lab called back. The nurse went back down to Charlotte's room. The lab called to say her blood levels dropped even more, and the nurse found Charlotte on the commode, slumped over, and she coded. She was no longer breathing, and she did not have a heartbeat.
So she died?
Essentially. They called a code, which means that they summoned all medical personnel who are on this code team, from the anesthesiologist to the medical physicians to the surgeons to the nursing staff, nursing supervisor, the pharmacist, a very grand team. They transferred her back into bed. They did CPR on her, so they were actually doing chest compressions on her. They intubated her, which means that they actually put her onto a respirator. her blood pressure was extremely low, and they began administering all different types of fluids and medications, and then they determined that she had this, they learned of this significant bleed. The bleed was equivalent to approximately 5 liters of blood that actually were just sitting in her abdomen. It was not pumping through her circulatory system. It was just sitting in her abdomen.
And just as a sense of perspective, the average woman probably has 6 liters of blood circulating in her body at any one time. So this means that there was very little blood that was nourishing the vital organs, the heart, the kidneys, the brain, the lungs.
Exactly, exactly. And during this code, they were sending for numerous units of blood. So they were just hanging bag after bag after bag of blood. And I believe during her critical time over that day and a few days later, she had received approximately 20 units of blood. Mm. That's a lot of blood that they needed to transfuse into her.
Let's stop for a moment and think about the role of anticoagulants in causing injury. Even in the best of circumstances, when everyone does everything right, anticoagulation can lead to significant toxicity and bleeding, permanent injury, paralysis, blindness, and death. Safe use requires understanding of how they work, the mechanism of interaction, the onset and duration of action, using antidotes, and recognizing and avoiding drug interactions. The standard of care requires thorough and careful ordering, compounding, labeling, distributing, administering, and monitoring by healthcare workers. I have a one-hour online training called Anticoagulation, Teetering on the Bleeding Edge. Our clinical pharmacist, Dr. James O'Donnell, discusses the liability and damages associated with anticoagulation so that you know as an LNC how to analyze these cases. Order this video training at http://lnc.tips/anticoagulation and use the coupon code LISTENED to get a 25% discount. That address again is http://lnc.tips/anticoagulation. Now let's get back to our program.
Now, how did you find out what was going on as her family member? You must have gotten a phone call, or were you in the hospital when this was going on?
I was actually on my way up that particular day. I had left my home at around 5 in the morning. It was a few hours away from where I was, and I actually received a call in the car letting me know that she had coded. I wasn't too far away, and upon my arrival, I was able to go right into the intensive care unit, and that's where everybody was still working on her. The CPR had stopped because her heart rate resumed, and she was on this machine that was doing the breathing for her. She had several units of blood that were going at the same time, and medications and intravenous fluids to help her maintain a blood pressure.
What was going through your mind and your emotions at that point?
I was, in a sense, paralyzed, looking at this horror scene, trying to figure out what has happened. Well, I went into the room, I walked out of the room, and one of the physicians, the attending physician, was actually on the computer at the time. And he and I had established a pretty good rapport, per se, during the hospitalization. And while I was at the computer and he was looking at her test results, the abnormal labs from the day prior, which had been reported to the nurse at 8 p.m., had just been entered into the computer at 6:43 a.m. from the day before.
Mm-hmm.
So this attending physician had no knowledge of the low lab levels. The physician who had been on call during the night never reported them to him, and the nurse never reported them either. So he was quite surprised. So little by little, when we are seeing these trickles of incidents, my eyes were certainly wide open trying to figure out how can we care for her, making sure that she lives and that things go well, and how can we make sure that whatever has happened here will not be repeated.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was my first glimmer, knowing that something was not quite right when we saw that computerized result, and then thinking back over the time as well with what her symptoms were and how some of our concerns as a family were dismissed by some of the healthcare teams.
What happened in Charlotte's medical care after that?
Well, we were escorted into a room, and the medical team spoke to my family about organ donation. Would we be interested in donating her organs, because there was no possible way that she could ever live because she had such a low lab level. And it really didn't take us long to make the decision that we were not going to donate her organs, because she came into this facility a very healthy woman, with the exception of the heartburn. She had just been skiing the day prior. So we had refused their offer, and they brought her to surgery, and there were more errors that had occurred during surgery, unfortunately. And there were just so many cascading events that occurred during her hospitalization that we had finally made the decision, when she had become somewhat stable, to transfer her out and move her to another major teaching facility.
Yeah, I would imagine that your sense of confidence in the hospital and its staff at that point was at an all-time low.
Exactly. Very true.
Then when she got into the new facility, what transpired in terms of her health and her recovery?
Well, it was a rocky road for her when she had arrived. She was with some really fabulous healthcare providers, from the physicians to all the therapists to all of the nursing staff. And she had another code at her new hospital, but the code was not caused by anyone. It was just because her condition had deteriorated a bit over time. And I actually happened to have been with her, and I happened to have been the person who called her code at that particular time, because when she was transferred, I was there quite a bit of the time, and I was very fortunate that the healthcare team permitted me, because I am in the healthcare field, to participate in the rounds, because I had so much knowledge and history on her, and that worked out well. But it was a rocky road for her. She was comatose for a period of time. She required additional surgeries, and these surgeries included she needed to have a tracheostomy, which is the tube moved from the mouth and moving it to the neck, because you can only have it in the mouth for a certain period of time, and because we don't want any tissue to be injured or deteriorate. So there's each healthcare facility determines what their window is for how long you can have that tube in the mouth. So she had the surgery for the trach, and we had to then figure out about nutrition for her. And they put a special tube in her stomach, a G-tube. She later got a J-tube. And these are special tubes. One of them was for all of her nutrition and her tube feedings. And they also needed to put special tubes all around her abdomen, four additional ones, to drain the abscess or the pus that was coming out of the abdomen. But she received excellent, excellent care at this facility. They were turning her. She never developed any bed sores. They were very aggressive with their care and management. While she was comatose, they were doing range of motion on her extremities to help prevent the muscles from becoming contracted. She really was cared for very well. And after being in this facility for a few months in the ICU, she was then transferred with a respirator over to a rehab facility. And when she arrived at the rehab facility, she was still on the respirator, but she had to learn how to do everything all over again. She had to learn how to turn herself in bed, how to sit up, how to walk, how to talk eventually, how to eat, how how to do all of these things that we take for granted. She had to learn how to do all of these things all over again. What we didn't realize, and we weren't sure of how she would be at this point, is we spoke about earlier, she lost so much blood, and the blood is what carries all of your nutrients to the various organs, but it also carries your oxygen up to your brain. Because she was without oxygen for a period of time, she actually ended up with what's known as an anoxic brain injury. So she ended up with profound memory issues. And that was extremely difficult as a family member to deal with and also for the healthcare providers to deal with.
Was she aware that she had lost some of her memory?
She became aware as she woke up more. Initially, she didn't know who I was, and then she realized, as time went on, who I was. We had to repeat things to her many times. She was very, very forgetful, and the rehab facility actually felt that she would need to go live in a nursing home. But her requests over the years were that she never wanted to live in a nursing home. She wanted to always live on her own or live with family. Since she lived several hours away from me, we ended up moving, she and my father, to an apartment close by so that way I could see them several times a day. And she eventually did come home. And we had to teach her many, many things again. When she began food shopping, she would go to the store. She had a little scooter initially, and then she'd return home, and then she'd go back out again because she'd forget that she already bought those items. Eventually, she did learn how to use her car again. That was after a long period of time. We even brought her to driver's ed, where they passed her off on the first driving lesson. She had the skill to drive a car, but what they didn't test for was asking her about her memory. So that was a little daunting for us as family, knowing that she's in a car and she'd forget where she was going. So I lived close by and she would forget where she was going. She'd forget to come to my house.
Mm-hmm. How many months was she in the acute care hospital and then in the rehab total?
In total, 6.5 months.
Wow. And then she came back still profoundly impaired, it sounds like.
Yes, she was, physically as well as mentally.
What happened to her in terms of her job? You said that she was a minister.
Yes, she actually lost her position as a minister, and she lost her housing because they needed to move somebody else into the parish to take over for the church.
So she's lost her memory, she's lost her way of life, she's lost her apartment or her independence.
Yes, and she's lost her friends from where because she had to move to another state. And she lost her life in what she had. She was such a different person afterwards. It was more that we had a little bit of role reversal, that I sort of, in a way, became her mother.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a little bit of resentment there. But she also lost her dog. Her dog was like a child to her, and the new facility that she moved into initially would not permit her to have her dog there, so we had to move her dog in with another family.
Mm-hmm.
So some major, major life changes.
And you mentioned your father. How was he coping with all of this?
He was not coping well at all because he had early Alzheimer's, and she was his health care provider, his caretaker, I should say. And now the roles were reversed. And here he was trying to help her. But we had some very interesting times. And to give you an example, I used to pour both of their medications in the pill boxes at the beginning of every week. And I would have everything labeled for them. And I also had a chart on the wall telling them what they needed to do at each time. And he wanted to save me a trip. And so he decided he would pour the pills. Well, I received a call at work one evening letting me know that he poured the pills, but he didn't have enough. Well, that sounded suspicious to me. And I went over there. I believe it was 12:30 at night when I got out of work, and I went over there. And what he did was he poured all the pills. So there were some medications that were as necessary, or also known as PRN medications. If you're nauseous and vomiting, you can take the following medication. Mm-hmm. Well, he never read the PRN, so he put every pill in every time slot.
Mm-hmm.
So that that could have been a disaster.
Yes, indeed.
Medications when they were not ordered.
In terms of her stomach, you mentioned that she had all these surgeries. Did she ever get relief from the heartburn that she had initially wanted to have the surgery for?
No, she didn't, because when they brought her back to surgery at that first facility and they removed all that blood from her abdomen, they had actually found during that surgery a couple of very interesting things. The scalpel, the harmonic scalpel, had actually lacerated one full side of the stomach. And then the other side of the stomach had actually necrosed. It actually died. So that part of it that was wrapped around the esophagus, had died. And another piece of information that we learned was that during the original surgery, which caused her pain initially, is that one of the instruments actually went through her liver. It pierced the liver, and that's why she was having so much abdominal pain.
Mm-hmm. What happened to her in terms of her physical recovery from all of this?
Her physical recovery, it was truly a challenge, because teaching someone how to walk again, we had a lot of balance issues initially, trying to get her to sit up and build up her endurance. Sitting up, sitting in a chair, and walking. It was truly a challenge. When she was finally discharged home, she was able to get up with the assistance of someone. And initially, my father didn't feel comfortable transferring her to a commode. So every time she needed to use the commode, I had to drive over to do the transfer for her, for both of them. So it was really, it was truly a challenge. She required one of the scooters. We got a scooter, and she was able to tootle around on that, which worked out well, although she was living in an apartment building that had a set of double glass doors, and one of her first ventures out on this scooter, she didn't realize the doors were there, and she actually drove right through them.
Oh.
Thankfully, nobody was injured. She didn't get injured from all the glass, and nobody was injured on the other side, but the facility actually put, as a result of this incident, put up these reflector markers, tapes that are on the doors, so that for other people in their building, they'll see these reflectors and know that there's glass there versus no glass.
Mm-hmm. Did Charlotte end up having any more surgery after this was all over?
Yes, she did. She had several subsequent surgeries. She had a surgery at this particular facility that I mentioned, where she had her original surgery done and what their discovery was. And that's where she had additional complications that occurred when it appeared that she didn't have a heart rate anymore. And so they moved their hands in her abdomen up to her heart because they had a very large incision down her abdomen. They wanted to touch her heart to make sure it was beating. And it was beating, and upon removal of the hands, one of the physicians put his right index finger through her lung.
Oof. Tell us about the hernias that she developed and what transpired after that.
As a result of when they had opened her abdomen and removed all that blood, and they had these special retention sutures on her abdomen, which looked like big elastic bands on her belly. The abdomen started pouching its way out, and she ended up developing two significant hernias on her abdomen. They were so significant that they were actually larger than breasts, and they were very painful for her. She didn't have any benefits of the surgery because she still had heartburn, but now what she ended up having was vomiting. Every time she would eat, she would vomit afterwards. The hernias were very painful. She couldn't even wear a seatbelt in a car. because these were pouching out.
Mm-hmm.
They were very uncomfortable for her and very difficult to get around as well. She was a petite woman in height, and all the clothes that were purchased, we had to have them specially altered for her.
Did she want to have these taken care of surgically?
She did. She did. A few years went by. She was told that she was a very high risk for complications, and she was also told there was a great possibility she may pass away. But she couldn't live with all the pain and the suffering that she was having, and she really wanted to try to have these taken care of. And she did. She went to the facility that helped save her life, and with full informed consent, we, the family, and she, we all sat down with the surgeon, learned all about the potential risks and complications, and she did have the surgery. The surgery was a success, but unfortunately, while in the recovery room, she started having her first glimmer of complications from putting these huge hernias back in. It then displaced her lungs, and she started having breathing problems and then kidney problems. Which we were well aware of beforehand, that there was a risk for this.
So she knew that it was risky, but she couldn't live with those hernias that resulted from this prior surgical catastrophe. What kinds of emotions were your family going through? Was your family going through during all this?
Well, when we had gone in to have this this surgery, she was a very bright and knowledgeable woman, and some of her memory had come back, thankfully. She actually wrote a 6-page letter telling us that she knew what the risks were, and if she passed away, it was okay because she would be with her husband, who had just passed away a short time prior to her having this surgery. And if she lived, these were all the things that she wanted to do if she lived. But she wanted us to know she truly knew what the risks were and what her wishes were. So we were scared, of course, but we felt comforted knowing we had such confidence in our healthcare providers at this particular facility. They kept us informed of everything that was going on with her. They communicated with us to tell us the risks and the benefits of all different procedures that were going on during this time. And they also, very importantly, they included Charlotte, as they should, because she's the patient. They included her in all the conversations and asked her what she wanted to do next.
Did she realize, do you think, that she was dying?
I do. I do.
And did she say anything to you specifically about this?
Yes. She was in the hospital during this hospitalization for 2 weeks, and during the first week, she was not on a respirator yet, but she was getting sicker and having more difficulty breathing, and she had stated to me on 3 different occasions, "You must tell my story. You must tell this story, because I don't want anyone else to have to endure the pain and suffering that I've had happen to me. I want others to learn from this and to take this and help prevent things from happening to their loved ones."
What happened next?
After a week's period of time, she needed to go on the respirator to do the breathing for her, and her kidneys became sicker and sicker as well, and she was on dialysis and medications. It was just one thing after another and after another, and unfortunately, her battle was lost, and she passed away.
That's an incredible story. What happened to your family, and what did you decide to do after Charlotte passed away?
Well, several different things we decided to do. We certainly wanted others to hear what happened to her, and I'm blessed that you and I are good friends, and we put together a great program to teach all around the world called Untangling Charlotte's Web to help teach healthcare providers her story. It's written in sort of a documentary way with a PowerPoint, as you know. And this story has been told internationally and here in the United States to healthcare facilities, to medical schools, nursing programs, to attorneys. And so we're looking to, you know, try to educate as many people as possible about what happened by personalizing this story so people are brought into the loop to realize that all it would have taken in Charlotte's case was one person, just one person, from stopping this series of events from occurring to her. But we also worked with the Joint Commission. And the Joint Commission is a group that helps to write up patient safety goals. And as a result of Charlotte's story, we now have two patient safety goals that affect every patient entering the hospital. And one is called critical lab values, and it's a way of communicating critical labs. And as I mentioned, her lab results were so low, the people were discounting the results and were not looking at the patient herself. So that was the first goal that was initiated. And the other one is safety in delivering anticoagulation, which is safety in delivering blood thinners. And this is very important. Now when patients are in the hospital and they're on blood thinners, they will be monitored by having certain blood tests will be done on a regular basis. And that's now a patient safety goal. So in Charlotte's case, there was such a long period of time that her bloods weren't monitored. Well, now we have the patient safety goal. That won't happen again, or we hope it doesn't.
So in one sense, Charlotte's story has affected patients all over the United States and as well as all over the world, because the Joint Commission accredits healthcare facilities in many different parts of the world besides the United States.
That is correct.
What lessons or tips would you provide to our listeners if they are caught up in a similar situation of realizing that things are going wrong with a family member and needing to get the attention of the healthcare providers?
Well, a couple things, actually. First off, I would encourage everyone to keep a folder of your loved one or your healthcare. That's very important to have. So that way, if there's something that happened in the remote past, it will jostle your memory, so you can communicate whatever that is to the physician. I also encourage every person to bring a loved one with them for their appointments or have loved ones visit them in the hospital, to be a second set of ears, because you need someone else to listen for you. Because sometimes when we're the patients, the patients may get confused, they may get forgetful for a variety of ways. So having someone with them is certainly very important to act as an advocate for them. I also encourage everyone, whenever you're starting with a new physician or whether you're going into the hospital, and to keep in this folder a list of all of your medications, the names of your medications, why you're on the medications, what the dosage is, the name of your physician, the telephone number, and the name of your pharmacist and the phone number. And not just keeping that in your folder, there should be a little piece of paper listing that within your wallet, so that if you're ever someplace, whether you're close to home or far away from home, you'll always have that with you to direct whatever healthcare provider is, I'm on these medications, and these are all the phone numbers. In addition to those medications, it's very, very important that the audience know that they must share all other medications with them as well. So such as your herbal medications, it's very important to share that information with the physicians, because some of the herbal medications can interact with medications that perhaps you're on or you may be placed on. For example, there are herbal medications that actually act as blood thinners. So the healthcare provider is not going to want you taking those medications prior to surgery, for example. So that would be something that is very important to discuss. It's also important, while you may think of just your prescription medications, the over-the-counter medications are very important to share with your physicians as well, such as Aleve or Advil or Alka-Seltzer or Ex-Lax or any of those. Those are very important medications that you have to share with your healthcare provider that you're taking these medications. If you are going into the hospital to have a surgery, the surgeon is going to inform you of what medications you can and can't take on the morning, perhaps, of surgery, but also he'll make recommendations as to how many days he wants you off some of your other medications. Some may just tell you the day before. It depends upon the medication, but it's very important to communicate that information to your physician, and very important to share if you're on any blood thinners, if you're on blood thinner by injection, or if you're on blood thinner pills. All of that information must be communicated to your physician.
I know in your capacity as a staff nurse that you work in a busy post-operative unit, and I'm sure that you have had a wide variety of experiences related to taking care of patients. Are there some tips that you can share with our listeners about how one can protect oneself or be in a safe environment in a hospital bed?
Yes, first off, I would suggest that everyone be active with their health care. And the research certainly shows that those who are involved with their health care tend to have better results. I also want to encourage the listeners that if they have a health care proxy, to bring that with them to the hospital. And if they don't have one, that's okay, because they can complete one upon admission. And what that says is that if the patient at some time has a difficult time making their own decisions, the patient is the one who's made the appointment of someone to make their decisions for them. It's also most important that if you have someone who's been made a do not resuscitate or do not intubate, perhaps they have a long-term health care, perhaps they have something that they have been very ill from, or maybe they're older and fragile and they're living in a situation that the family has made that decision and the patient has made that decision, make sure you tell the hospital and the physician that this person is a do not intubate or a do not resuscitate, so the wishes are continued. And bring that document also to the hospital. If you are going into the hospital to have a surgery, or perhaps you were admitted under urgent conditions and you need surgery, make sure you ask what type of surgery are you having, and you must understand why you're having the surgery. You should also ask how long will the surgery take and what will happen after the surgery. But also, you should ask from the physician, what can I expect during the time of recovery? And this will just give some guidance to you as you're planning to undergo this surgery. To those in the audience whose loved ones are going into the hospital or they themselves are going in, make sure that you avoid bringing medications into the hospital. We have seen patients try to self-administer medications, and they may try to give themselves the medications that we're giving as well, and we don't want that to happen. Now, certainly, sometimes there's hospitals that don't have certain special medications that someone may be on. That would be something that you would need to communicate with the physician, and he would make that determination if you should bring or need to bring any of your own medications in as well. Other things, when you're going into the hospital, avoid bringing your own clothes, and whether they're new or old initially. And the reason I state that is because when you're in the hospital and you may have some bleeding or discharge from a wound, you certainly don't want to get your clothing messy with that. But at such a time when you are starting to get out of bed, you do want shoes that have good traction. So the old clothes, you don't want old shoes. Please leave those at home, because we want shoes that have good traction to assist you when you're ambulating or when you're out of bed and you're walking around, for sure. Other helpful hints are have to do with the call light. And this is truly an area that has gained lots of attention over the time for a variety of reasons. When you use your call light, it's really important that you identify who you are and what your need is. Instead of saying, I need a nurse, if you explain to whomever is answering the call light, which oftentimes is a clerk, and you can say, my name is Mary, I need someone to help me with the bedpan, or my name is Mary, I would like to have my pain medications. If you can explain that to the clerk, it's actually going to make time will become much more friendly and efficient for you, because that person at the desk, if they hear it's the bedpan, a nursing assistant could come into the room. If they hear it's the medication, they would then contact the nurse, who can then go get the medication. So you're saving yourself some time there. Instead of having one person come and then leave to go then find the nurse who will ultimately need to be the one who administers your medication. So that's going to help you gain a prompt response instead of saying, I need the nurse. Or if you're sitting up at the edge of the bed, another example, if you call and you start slipping and you just say, I need the nurse, it's not telling them how urgent you need someone. So if you need someone quickly, explain, I need a nurse, I'm slipping out of the bed, would be an example of something to say.
Could you comment at all on getting along with the nurses and the nursing staff and the aides? Any helpful hints?
Yes. It's definitely a huge tip would be nice to the nurse and be nice to the nursing assistants. Because if you're going to be nice to them, they'll respect you. Well, they would respect you anyways, even if you weren't nice. But certainly, you know, camaraderie can go a long way, and the nurse is going to be much happier and more willing to assist and maybe do extra things for you if you have a good relationship. Certainly, no nurse should ever ignore a patient, but certainly you'll get a lot more out of a nurse if you're friendly to them. The nurse could share information, critical pieces of information. She might be able to offer you some suggestions, and she'd be more willing to do that. I do want to mention one other thing, if we could just go back to the call light. A very helpful piece of advice would be if the patient or the family member ever uses a call light and they don't receive a response within a short period of time, do not hesitate to contact the nurse again or call the front desk again. Because sometimes that nurse, she could be busy with another patient. Maybe she was never given the message. But it's very important that the patient ring that call light again. And most certainly, the patient should never get out of bed unassisted unless the nurse has already given the patient that approval. So even if somebody has to go to the bathroom, they haven't been out of bed before, and they ring the call light and they don't see the nurse, absolutely, they should not be getting out of bed by themselves unattended.
That's good advice. What if you end up in a double bed with a roommate and there are problems with that roommate? What can you do?
Well, that certainly has happened at times because there's numerous situations which have come up, whether it's the roommate has many, many family members or has different habits than what you have, or maybe they were up all night and you were trying to sleep. Communicate with a nurse. Explain to her that you're having a hard time. Explain why, and you can also inquire if there's another room on the floor that perhaps you could be moved to another bed on that unit. And that happens quite often, and that's certainly a very easy thing to be able to do if the bed is available.
One of the things that people talk a lot about is medication errors. Do you have any tips to share with us about how to avoid being on the receiving end of a medication error in the hospital?
Yes. Make sure that you pay attention when the nurse is administering your medications. So the nurse should be coming to your room with all the medications in their little individual packets. And listen to her as she's explaining what medications you're given. And if you have questions about a medication or a name that does not sound familiar, don't hesitate to ask the nurse what that medication is for. Also, it's very important, if you don't hear one of your normal medications in that list of medications, don't hesitate to inform the nurse, I usually take this medication as well. Is the doctor aware? Perhaps he wants to put me back on it, or maybe there's a reason he doesn't want the patient on it. But definitely have a discussion with the nurse about that. And she can always contact the physician, too, explaining that you usually take a certain medication and it hadn't been ordered, and do they want to reorder it.
And speaking of the physician, I thought we could wrap up by talking a little bit about communicating with the physician who's in charge of your care when you're in the hospital. What suggestions can you offer our listeners about getting your questions answered by the physician?
Well, you want to make sure you know who's in charge of your care. Some facilities, you may have numerous doctors, but who's the one who's managing all of the care? That would be one question to have answered, because you may have several different healthcare teams involved. You may have pulmonary for your lungs, you may have a renal doctor for your kidneys, and you may have a hospitalist or an internal medicine person. So you want to know who you're speaking with. When you're speaking with your physician, hopefully your physician is one that will enter your room and sit at your bedside or come close to you so that way you can ask your questions. I encourage my patients to make a list of questions or concerns of what they have for their physicians, because sometimes, while in a hospital, physicians may do rounds at a very early time. It could be as early as 5:30 or 6 in the morning. So at that time, when you're waking up the patients, they may just be a little dazed. So by having this list, it certainly helps them. I also encourage them to have all their questions at once, because trying to get a physician later in the day when they could be in the operating room or they could be elsewhere sometimes can be a little bit challenging just to get a question answered. So you may end up waiting till the next day, unless it's something of great concern that has come up. Some of my patients have actually suggested to me, and I've seen this, they actually reach out and they shake the doctor's hand. Hello, it's so nice to see you again. Thank you for caring for me. And by offering that extension of the hand and the handshake, we'll engage the physician as well.
I have also heard of some patients who have not been satisfied with waiting a long time for a physician to answer a question, and they've actually picked up their hospital phone and dialed the physician's office and asked that the physician contact them or see them. And boy, does that get people coming fast when that occurs.
I have seen that. People have done that. People have also paged them in the hospital. I have seen that. So if the patient can obtain, can ask all their questions when the physician comes by, but certainly there's so many times that people may forget a question, and some of the questions the nurse can answer because she's done rounds with the physician. So don't hesitate to ask your nurse if you have additional questions, because she may be able to page the doctor. Many of the hospitals actually have a texting page system, so they may actually enter this text, and so then when the physician is free, he can return the call with the answer. So don't hesitate to ask your nurse. She may very well know. And if she doesn't know the answer for you, she can try to obtain that answer for you, so you're not waiting for an answer.
Well, in the last few minutes, we have covered certainly a lot of very practical information for people who are in the hospital. We encourage the individuals who are listening to this to print out the transcript and keep it in a handy place, and also to consult some of the checklists and special reports that we have put on Avoid Medical Errors in the membership area in the inner circle, as well as to keep watching the site for additional information that will be coming. I appreciate the time that you've spent with us, Barbara. You have told us a very detailed and also a very sad story about a vibrant, intelligent, accomplished woman who went in for what was supposed to be a one-day surgery and ended up having such a horrible, complex result. And I appreciate your courage and also the fact that you are carrying out your mother's wishes by sharing the story with our listeners. Is there anything else that you would like to conclude with, Barbara, before we stop our program for tonight?
Yes, one last remark, just to emphasize that if any of the patients have questions, make sure that they ask. Healthcare providers come and go for their shifts, and it's the patient who's laying in the bed waiting and wondering. So if they didn't get their question answered earlier, you know, certainly make sure they ask that question again. Make sure they get their answers to their questions.
Thank you, Barbara Levin, for sharing your expertise and your wisdom and your very personal story.
Thank you very much.
Use the code LISTENED to get a 25% discount on this product. You'll put that code LISTENED in the coupon code box during checkout.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on iTunes. We always are interested in your ideas for new topics. Please leave a comment on legalnursepodcasts.com. Join our community and get notified of each new episode and receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on legalnursepodcasts.com. We appreciate you and your interest.